The following programming is sponsored by Joseph J. Fallon and M. Scott Dawson. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time now to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. and well-known cardiologist Dr. M. Scott Dawson team up to bring you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Produced by world-renowned philanthropist Cal Rubin, this could be the most important radio show you'll ever listen to. Now, here are Drs. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. and M. Scott Dawson for another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and South Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine. I think we're up to over 120 programs at this time, and the website is available at www.wwdbam.com. Go to Inside Medicine and then hit podcast. We have a international guest on today, and I'm sure you're going to appreciate Dr. Costanzo. I just want to open up and say, Ditter, has COVID-19 got you down yet? Lo and behold, Omicron variant with 50 mutations just hit the world scene. Of course, that dropped the stock market, commodity market, and all sorts of markets on Friday. There is a 1,200 increase in cases in South Africa, and that is an indication that of the 231 million Americans who have one shot, we want to make sure that they get their second vaccine. And we also want to make sure that anybody who is relying on antibodies has to realize that just getting an antibody test doesn't tell the whole story. The antibodies, the immune system is very complex. We have B cells which induce antibodies that would fight an invader. We have T cells that also come alive and kill viruses and the cells that they're in. So there's a lot the immune system has, but it's not available in an antibody test. So the bottom line is don't count on asking your doctor for antibody tests. It's not really going to help you out by finding that answer because the immune system is a little bit more complex, and as we can see, this new variant has 50 mutations, which make it a lot more contagious. So Inside Medicine is ready to roll. We have a phenomenal guest today, Albert R. Costanzo, MD, FAAP. He's a medical director, assistant, and regional aviation of International SOS. He's board certified in pediatrics and internal medicine, along with 34 years of clinical experience in emergency medicine. As medical director of assistance in regional aviation, he is responsible for medical case management over international SOS medical assistant activities, particularly throughout the Americas region. That includes South America, North America, etc. This involves medical input and supervision over assistant integration and support of medical services and site operations in the region, including site health reviews, medical emergency response plans, and medical transportation. Al is fluent in Spanish. He has conducted extensive site surveys and audits accrediting medical facilities and air ambulance providers throughout Latin America, and has been a medical escort for multiple patient transport. Dr. Costanzo completed his MedPeds training residency at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia, and he has continued to work as an emergency medical physician to this date. He joined International SOS in 1999, working in various capacities as coordinating doctor, chief medical officer, and TRICARE medical director. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Association of the Emergency Physicians, and the American College of Forensic Examiners, period. He is a certified medical examiner for the Department of Transportation and certified in travel health throughout the International Society of Travel Medicine. Al, I ran out of breath, so it's time to ask you to hop on. How are you doing today?
Thank you for that extensive introduction. Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Listen, so basically you travel the world. Can you discuss the standard or discrepancy of care available in other countries because I remember a physician came to me and said, Dr. Fallon, I want every test done, and I'm going to Africa, and in that particular country, there are two patients in each bed, exclamation point.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about your travels.
Well, what we see in major countries, what's called first world countries, North America, Europe, Australia, there's a generally well-established and well-distributed standard of care throughout the country, meaning that the quality, the standards of medical treatment throughout most cities within the country are maintained. Anywhere you go in the U.S., for example, there's a certain quality of care that is maintained for the most part, so that the same level of basic triage and care is expected. There's a reliable system in place so that if the care is not available in that particular institution or facility, then there is a protocol in place to transfer them to a higher level of care that is regionally available nearby. But in other parts of the world, in the developing world, the highest level of care is usually found in capital cities. The farther away you get from the capital city or the main, you know, larger city, the more likely you are to encounter a lower standard of medical care, which means diminished capability, resources, less quality of care. So this means that there's a greater need to transfer those patients to the nearer facility that may sometimes be outside of the country. And this process, the transport, needs to be achieved through whatever available assets there may be locally. Now, I think it's important to speak a little bit about the concept of public versus private care in most of these countries. Healthcare can be provided through public and private providers. Public healthcare is delegated through government-funded national healthcare systems, and private healthcare is provided through for-profit hospitals and self-employed practitioners. So most countries, the U.S. for the most part blatantly excluded, provide free medical care to their population through these public government-subsidized health systems. We can see that in Canada, we see that in the U.K., we see that in most European nations and South American nations as well. So the private healthcare system delivers healthcare to low and middle income countries and sometimes is arguably more efficient. It's available, but at a cost. Whereas the public sector is frequently fraught with diminished resources because it is government subsidized. You know, there's all driven by governmental economic fluctuations and this drives down performance and quality. So the private health system, for the most part, provides a higher caliber of care. And this is where most foreigners that are in those countries are driven to, simply because there is a financial motivation for these private healthcare providers to deliver a higher quality of care in a more expedited fashion.
So when you have to go see a patient, fly to, helicopter to, how do you assess the need for repatriation or evacuation of that patient from that site?
Well, several factors come into play here. The first, obviously, the request for the individual involved or from family members for a patient that can't voice their own opinion, you know, needs to be taken into consideration. That's usually what comes into play as the initial key element that motivates the need for evacuation or repatriation. But we need to assess what level of care is being rendered relative to the clinical situation that is prevailing. If the patient's in a major hospital getting adequate care and there's absolutely no urgency to move that individual at a substantial cost and potential risk, then it stands to reason to keep them where they are, receiving proper care until we can downgrade those recommendations to less costly options, such as a commercial flight. We also take into consideration what the medical situation is. What if it's a minor condition that can be easily managed with the resources at hand, then the patient doesn't really require an upgrade in care, although they may be requesting it, and that obviously may prevail with regards to the decision-making process. If there is any risk imposed by the transport itself, you know, if you're dealing with a medical condition such that moving the patient could potentially incur additional risk, aggravating the medical condition, then we need to reassess the situation whether it's appropriate or not. Somebody with a precarious hemodynamic status, putting them on a plane with multiple stops, takeoff and landing, incurring additional stress and oxygen demand by virtue of the decreased cabin pressure alone. Most pressurized cabins in aircraft are at about 8,000 feet. That alone incurs a small, sometimes not insignificant, oxygen demand for those patients that, you know, may not have the capability and reserve to maintain that. So that could worsen the medical situation, and that means that we need to rationalize, you know, whether it's appropriate to transfer the patient. And finally, you know, the cost itself, who's going to pay for the service? This is a lot more expensive than people think. you know, for the most part, you know, these flights are done on small jets, a Lear jet, 35, 45. You know, that usually breaks down to about roughly $2,300, $2,500 an hour. A Gulfstream, which is a much larger aircraft, you're talking about upwards of $3,000 an hour. In terms of mileage, to give you an approximate estimate, a trip from Cancun, Mexico to southern United States can easily be anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000. Many of the Caribbean islands are, you know, three times as far. You're looking at, you know, $40,000 to $50,000, and the farther you go across the ocean, you know, European destinations, you're looking at 4,000 miles plus. Now you're looking at the cost of an air ambulance that could be upwards of $100,000 or more.
So let me ask you this, based on those costs, can people purchase, or patients, future patients purchase insurance for this? And does anybody have any idea how much it's going to cost?
Well, the cost is something that needs to obviously be taken into consideration. And some insurance companies cover the cost. But that all depends on whether that has been purchased beforehand and whether they have that particular rider that covers that the cost for such transport. For example, when you're looking at an insurance policy that was bought beforehand, then by all means, you know, if it's understood and the fine print has been read, then we could be understood that they'll be covering the cost for such. But needless to say, need to understand who the paymaster is going to be. Sometimes it's an insurance policy. Sometimes it's, if it's an employee of an international company, it may be relative to the employer, him or herself, whether they're going to be taking the cost for that transport. Sometimes it's somebody with deep pockets, somebody that is asking whether they can be transported, understanding that this is going to be done, and most of these are done with payment up front, so that, you know, they're going to have to undertake the payment of this beforehand. And if they have an insurance policy that may be covering them, then that will be done on the back end. Somebody having an MI, for example, somewhere in the Caribbean islands, and the standard of care is to have cardiac catheterization that may not be available locally, then the transfer for that air ambulance to take them to, say, South Florida, in order to achieve that higher level of care, may be something that the insurance company will cover. But once again, they want to have substantial confirmation that there's a need for that in order to be able to substantiate the cost for it. So if an insurance is looking to pay for it, you need to understand that they're going to want medical justification to justify such.
So Dr. Costanzo, I mean, so that means that when you're called International SOS, do you already have confirmation that the patient has the degree of illness that would require transport, or do you have to get there and sometimes say it's not really necessary? It seems like you got a big job there, because it's hard to tell somebody who's having an acute heart attack whether they need to get a stent right away and transport it to, say, South Florida.
Well, it's not always readily available. We got to go with the information that's being given to us. We always try to communicate directly with the medical team and the medical professional that is handling the patient, get firsthand information from them to understand what has been done and what the limitations of care there may be. Sometimes they're difficult to get to. They will not, you know, release the information. We need consent from the patient, obviously. A lot of times they're reluctant to give that information because they feel that, you know, we're plucking the patient away from them. There's a financial motivation many times to keep the patient there. So we need to make them understand that we're working in the best interest of this patient, and there's a request to move them to a higher level of care or back to their home country, what we call repatriation, and get them to buy into it, per se. So we have to work with whatever information we have and make a decision based on the request from the patient or the family and what we feel is in the best interest of that patient to move them expeditiously to a higher level of care. Sometimes we get cooperation from the medical team, sometimes we don't. What we try to avoid at all costs is try to have them sign out AMA, against medical advice. Sometimes it's necessary, you know, but needless to say, we don't get much cooperation when that, you know, frequently is the case. So we try to avoid that scenario as much as possible.
So that sounds like a tough job. Are you the one who, when your transport plane would land, that you have to evaluate from the medical team and then the patient and decide which way things go? Are you the one with the in the hot seat?
Well, the medical team that comes with the ground, the air ambulance, is the one that makes that decision. We try to give them as much information as we have, These are subcontracted providers. They're providers, particularly here in the United States, we have the privilege of having multiple air ambulance providers that are accredited, and we subcontract them to do those services. We provide all the information that we have. Frequently, they try to call the facility themselves and try to confirm or gather additional information. If it's another country, many times there may be language difficulties. This is where we have, translators and, people that speak many different languages to be able to provide direct communication between the doctor and the ambulance personnel. But ultimately, it's happened in a few times where they arrive at the bedside and the patient is a lot more critical than the information that we had gathered or they had gotten. So a decision is made by the air ambulance personnel, and these are basically ICUs in the air. So they come with a doctor, they come with a nurse, they come with all the equipment that is necessary in order to be able to manage a patient. What sometimes happens in some of these smaller hospitals is that putting the patient on the air ambulance itself is a step up in care. They themselves have better equipment and better training to be able to manage a critically ill patient. So ultimately, it's on a case-by-case basis many times when they arrive at the bedside and a patient is critically ill or deemed to be unstable that the decision is made that, the better option here may be to put him on the air ambulance because he's got a better chance of survival. Those are few and far between, but those instances do occur.
So is it always costly to get an air ambulance, or is sometimes it, but of course life means a lot. So is it always costly, or obviously if you've got your insurance, you can get back and you can get your stent if you need it, et cetera?
Well, the cost obviously is contingent on where the resources are coming from, what type of aircraft is being used, and the distance that is being encountered here to move the patient to a higher level of care or bringing them back home. But as I mentioned before, a lot of times the question comes in, the request comes in from an anxious individual that they want to be extracted from that location, and we need to determine whether the paymaster, whether it's going to be themselves or whether it's going to be an insurance company or whether it's going to be their employer, are agreeable to undertake such additional cost. So we have to justify what is medically necessary and what we feel is medically appropriate, because any insurance company and or any employer is going to want justification for the cost that is going to be expended, which, as I mentioned before, can be at times hundreds of thousands of dollars to move such a patient. So the more medical information that we have, the more justification we can provide, and the better way of moving these patients are without having to undertake additional expense that they are not prepared to undertake at that time. Bear in mind that all these are done payment up front. The payment has to be given up front, or a guarantee of payment has to be given up front, so that we can launch the aircraft before we can undertake the mission. The other limiting factor many times is actually making sure that there is a receiving facility that is prepared to take the patient. In today's day and age of pandemic times, with the limited bed availability, many times we've been delayed in being able to confirm the receiving care, confirm an accepting doctor, having a bed available for that individual to be arriving to. You certainly don't want to launch an aircraft and have a patient have no bed available. We can't essentially dump them into an emergency room. That's not the proper thing to do for patients, and it's not the right business thing to do for a company that is moving patients worldwide to simply take a patient to a hospital that is not prepared to accept a patient and have an accepting doctor. So that generates further delays many times. Every step of the way needs to be in place. There has to be what we call bed-to-bed arrangements on the ground transport from where the patient's at to the airport, the air transport of the patient to the receiving location, and the ground transport to the receiving hospital with an accepting doctor, so that there is a streamlined process in place so that there is no hiccups with regards to transport and nobody that is unwilling or unprepared to accept the patient.
So I can see, Al, that this is a very complicated issue. So does International SOS, if you go down to an island, say, and you have to find a bed appropriate for that patient, do you already start to do that from what you heard from the medical team, but maybe get surprised that the patient's worse or better than is? And do you guys have to locate a place, say Texas is closer or Florida is closer, or somebody says, I want to go to Jefferson in Philadelphia or Penn in Philadelphia, Temple in Philadelphia? Do people have that option? How do you guys work that out? Because like you said, you want to go bed to bed.
Well, of course, if individuals want to go back to their home and that is not what's called the nearest center of medical excellence, the closest medical facility that can appropriately handle a particular mission, you know, we take that into consideration relative to the underlying medical condition. Of course, if it's somebody that's had major trauma, for example, somebody that's had the sudden diagnosis of cancer, where we anticipate long-term care, where it makes more sense for that individual to be going back home, whether he's going to have social and family support, then doing it as a what's called a primary repatriation, where we fly that patient all the way back home, becomes more appropriate. However, that may be much more costly because there's an additional distance to take into consideration. And a lot of these insurance companies, if they're the paymasters, are not going to be able to confront that or not unwilling to confront that simply because their policy covers you with what's called the nearest center of medical excellence. However, if we can make a justification and we make a rational argument to the point that if we move him to the nearest center and he gets the appropriate acute care, now he needs convalescent care, rehabilitative care, and he still needs another air ambulance because he's so compromised to get him back home, then it makes much more sense to move him directly all the way home as the primary repatriation. Another consideration is a lot of times these insurance companies are paying for the medical expenses themselves in the initial location. So now if they can transfer the liability and cost of medical care at the receiving end, if there's another insurer involved, if they come back here to the United States, for example, and say Medicare is going to pick up the cost of medical expenses, then they're absolving themselves of additional medical expenses. So it may be more financially prudent for them to undertake the cost of a longer flight if they absolve themselves of further liability and exposure when they arrive at another hospital where the medical care is going to be taken over by a different insurance company.
I got to tell you, Al, I can tell you've been at this business for a while. you know the answers before I ask a question. Let me just move ahead. As COVID and this pandemic altered the process of patient transport, I bet it does.
Actually, yes, it has, absolutely. Essentially, when you look at COVID and what has happened with COVID, you know, there are five different buckets of patients that we're transferring. You have basically a patient that doesn't have COVID, has some other medical condition. You have somebody that basically has COVID, but has an additional diagnosis, something that may look like COVID but isn't, and then somebody that's been exposed but no symptoms, and somebody that's definitely COVID. So the arrangements can certainly be much more difficult, simply because COVID-positive individuals have to be transported within a single aircraft in order to maintain appropriate infection control measures and, you know, obviously prevent contagion to the other members of the aircraft, the medical team, and the crew, whether they're using a personal protective equipment as frequently as the case, or whether if somebody is COVID positive and is having symptoms, they need to use a portable isolation unit. Besides that, what's happened and we've seen throughout this pandemic is that the nationality of a specific patient makes significant difference whether the patient is going to be accepted in a country outside of their own. For obvious reasons, you know, countries are obligated to accept their own citizens and their own residents, but you know, they're reluctant many times to accept individuals that are not citizens of their own country. So for the most part, at this point, most governments are accepting return of their own nationals, but in places where there's a significant patient load of coronavirus on their own, some countries are declining to admit third country nationals coming over to their care. So now we have no choice but to bring them all the way back home where the distance may be significantly longer and obviously a much higher cost. So keep in mind that any individual that's confirmed to be positive through appropriate testing, regardless of whether they have symptoms or not, you know, that has to be transferred in a designated aircraft that has appropriate infection control measures, whether it's personal protective equipment or the chamber that I mentioned, which is an individual isolation chamber that we've used many times as well. And the decision whether they use that chamber or not is entirely up to the medical crew that is doing the transport. The setup time for these can certainly be longer. And obviously now you're looking to get permits to land in the country. You're looking to get permits in all the layovers that are flying back to where the destination may be. Most of these may take, you know, upwards of, you know, 48 hours. There's major obstacles also in securing beds in the destination, depending on you know, how the COVID situation has progressed in that given country. We've had, at various times throughout the past year and a half, multiple times where we've had significant delays simply because there were no beds available. As recent as a couple of months ago, we're transporting a patient to Chicago. There were no beds available. We couldn't find a bed anywhere. We ended up having to move the patient farther down into Indiana simply because there were no beds available as a result of the COVID load itself. So this adds additional time. We have to accomplish these movements. By the time that we activate an air ambulance, it may be upwards of 6-7 days before we finally achieve the transport of such patient, which can have significant impact on somebody that's critically ill.
So let me ask you this. Another one that always came to my mind is Ebola, because that was frightful, and I'm glad I wasn't in your business when Ebola was hot. Have you had to deal with Ebola patients?
We did manage some patients moving out of Africa into Western Europe, per se. What happened with Ebola was that the movement of such patients required significant isolation measures and isolation chambers that were not readily available with most air ambulance providers. There was only one air ambulance provider based out of Atlanta here in the U.S., which is the one that moved the American patient, as you recall, out of Sierra Leone back to the United States. And that was a very complicated process and a large isolation chamber that was configured into that aircraft. And that air ambulance provider is contracted primarily to the U.S. State Department. So their aircraft are only specifically available for U.S. Governmental requests, per se. So there's very limited capability to transport something like Ebola. Luckily, there weren't that many patient transports, and certainly it didn't evolve into the worldwide pandemic that COVID evolved into. But with COVID, as with Ebola, obviously there are significant infection control measures that need to be kept in place in order to prevent spread of the disease among the crew and the medical crew on the air ambulance itself. And keep in mind also, there may be quarantine measures also. If somebody's been exposed to someone that is positive, what we've run into also at times is that the medical crew on some of these flights may be subjected to quarantine when they finally arrive at their base. Now you're taking them out of commission for an additional 10, 15 days simply because they've been exposed and they can't even go about their daily business because they were exposed, even though they may not have symptoms or not. So this imparts a huge implication with regards to delays and with regards to measures that are understandably undertaken to prevent infection spread, but likewise have huge societal impact on those individuals that are undertaking these missions in order to help these individuals.
So Al, it sounds like a very tough job to me. I mean, so considering that there's risk to the crew, considering that there's risk when you get it back to the destination, are there any conditions that are actually a no-no that you just will not transport based on risk to the transporters or where the destination is? Is there any conditions or patients that are excluded?
Well, the severity of the condition is certainly something that needs to be taken into consideration. Patients, for example, are on ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Very difficult to transport an individual that requires continuous ECMO. There are certainly military aircraft that do it and have done it. There are a handful of civil aviation air ambulance providers that can do it, but a patient that requires ECMO is a patient, for the most part, that is not going to be able to be transported as such, with some exceptions to be kept in mind. Patients that may have a greater risk of demise during the process of transfer. If there's increased demand of oxygen consumption, if they're already on maximal oxygen support, there's only so much oxygen you can give. As I mentioned before, keep in mind that any time that you put somebody in the air, there is a chance that they're going to require more oxygen. The cabin pressure at 8,000 feet in and of itself demands slightly higher oxygen administration. And if you're already on oxygen, maximal oxygen support, those individuals may be getting into problems. Somebody with a pneumothorax or somebody who's got trapped air, they need to be transported primarily at lower cabin pressure. We talk about sea level cabin pressure, which is never sea level. I mean, it's always at a lower cabin pressure. Usually, if a cabin pressure is at 8,000, they can lower it up to maybe 2,000 or 3,000. in order to be able to prevent that trapped air from expanding. As the pressure decreases when you're going up into the air, any trapped air, following Boyle's law, if you remember basic physiology, is going to expand. And we expect it to expand anywhere from 20 to 30%. Now somebody with trapped air over the pneumothorax can certainly lead to a potential tension pneumothorax, so we need to keep that into consideration. By flying at a lower level, then there's less chance of that expansion of gas, but by virtue of that, needless to say, there is greater jet fuel consumption, and there is a chance that they're going to have to refuel during that transport, and needless to say, it's going to take longer, and there's going to be an additional out-of-hospital time that could be detrimental to that patient as well. So
I got to tell you, Al, when you're talking about transporting an ECMO patient, I think people have to understand that they're the sickest of the sick, somebody with COVID, and that requires you're taking blood out and bypassing the lung, and
exactly.
That's a very sick patient, man. That's a sick mm-hmm. patient. And then you think about these football games, somebody gets a punctured lung, and now you're thinking about flying them in an airplane up there and that the air in their chest could expand and then compress their lung and they would die from that. You do take care of sick people, don't you?
Well, they can be quite sicker than you originally anticipate. As you mentioned before, you get to the bedside, so frequently you understand that this patient is a lot sicker than the information that you've gotten. So you're juggling several different dishes at the same time to make a decision that you're not posing further risk when moving this individual than can be generated by keeping him where he is at and hope that he gets better.
It requires a lot of medical judgment, and I am glad it's you doing it, Al, not me. Let me say that. but you talked about air flight, jet flight, different sizes of planes. Do helicopters ever come into this transport issue?
Well, helicopters, you have a range of maybe 200 to 250 miles. I mean, it's usually a short range, moving within a given country, within a given state here in the United States, or frequently coming offshore. I mean, these are transport measures. When you have rigs offshore, we frequently provide medical support to these rigs and individuals that get obviously ill or have a significant trauma on board the rig, then they're transported by helicopter onshore. But it's a much smaller place, much more crowded. There's no passengers allowed. Usually when we transport patients on air ambulances, for the most part, we allow a family member to travel with them, if they find themselves available or not. Obviously, with a helicopter, there's much more crowded space. There's no passengers allowed. There's restrictions with regards to nighttime flying, although some helicopters can fly at nighttime. Nighttime helicopters usually require two pilots. They need special certifications to do so. Landing can be a problem. There's limited access to landing in some locations, although certainly you don't need a runway. But nevertheless, you need to be very careful with regards to where a helicopter can land in some of these more remote locations. An air ambulance fixed-wing aircraft is essentially an ICU in the air with no less than two properly trained medical personnel, a doctor or a nurse, sometimes a respiratory therapist if it's necessary, and it's a pressurized cabin. So most jets can be manipulated, as I mentioned, to manipulate that pressurized cabin as needed for the clinical situation. But the range is much longer. I mean, there's less turbulence because they're flying at a much higher altitude, so there's less risk of that in and of itself being a critical factor with regards to moving a patient. But the main thing with helicopters is their limited range. Literally.
Yeah. So the other item is that I took care of a patient once who had jumped into the ocean and actually had a cervical lesion. And I'll never forget the helicopter pilot was sitting there, chain smoked, I think, two packs of cigarettes, waiting for us to get him, properly attired so that there would be no neck movement. And I remember him saying, I got to get this airplane, the helicopter off without a shake, and I got to land it without a shake. And this is just my day to do my job. Do you do much neck injuries like that?
We've done several spinal cord injuries, with proper support. Obviously, getting him off of a rig, for example, with a helicopter, as you mentioned, in and of itself is a challenge. But once you've gotten them to a medical facility where they can be further stabilized, We certainly have moved patients with full spinal support on stretchers that are transported on an air ambulance, fixed-wing air ambulance at that point, to the nearest center that can provide higher level of care. By all means, if it's a precarious situation where the patient has not been fully paralyzed but could by any minimal movement, then it becomes a huge judgment call whether you're rendering further benefit by moving him as opposed to doing whatever can be done to stabilize him surgically before that movement. But sometimes that level of medical care and expertise is not available. So you have to make a judgment call to move him with as much support as you can to prevent further injury simply because you need to get him to a higher level of care.
So Al, I mean, you've got, I didn't know how much challenge this job is that you have. And I would definitely recommend that cigarette smokers, push their product to helicopter transport specialists because they would sell a lot of cigarettes. Just go over that destination that a patient wants to go to again. So, because there's a money issue, but there's also a life issue. And how, do you run into that trouble more than I would think? In other words, I want them back home or whatever. Do you run into the family being a problem in terms of trying to make them live?
Yeah, the destination can be very straightforward as the nearest center of medical excellence, as I mentioned, particularly if the decision for that coverage comes from an insurance company that's paying for the transport. But at times, it becomes necessary to transfer a patient all the way back home to their residence. And usually, the patient and the family prefers that. But needless to say, the cost is a major impediment that needs to be dealt with. If we're dealing with a medical condition, as I mentioned before, that requires long-term care, rehabilitation, somebody's diagnosed as, having, God forbid, metastatic cancer, and you know that this is going to require long-term care, then it appears that it makes more sense to bring him all the way back home rather than having it stepwise, doing an initial evacuation to a center that can provide the initial acute care to stabilize him and then subsequently move him. But insurance companies are looking at the bottom dollar. So if it's going to cost thousands of dollars to move him on an air ambulance to a major medical center, and then once the patient's stabilized, they're able to essentially downgrade their cost by moving him on a commercial aircraft as opposed to an air ambulance, then frequently they will opt for that. But regardless of what the patient may ask, if the patient themselves or the employer of such patient, if they're undertaking the cost, understands the implications that it's better for this patient to go all the way back home and they're willing to undertake the higher cost, then needless to say, that is the decision that is made to move them accordingly. And the other thing that needs to be kept in mind here with regards to EMTALA, the federal law basically that mandates that any patient transfer within the U.S., and that's the key element, this is within the U.S., there has to be a proper transfer of information with direct communication between sending and receiving doctors from one facility to another. Well, EMTALA doesn't apply for patients that are coming in from outside of the United States, unless it's in one of the U.S. territories. So when we're coordinating the receiving care, and all these transfers, as I mentioned, are done bed to bed, many times the accepting doctor wants to speak directly to the sending physician, because that's what they're used to when they get transfers from another facility here in the United States. This becomes a problem. If there's language or cultural obstacles, if there's time zones involved, the patients are being treated on the other side of the world. So again, we try to facilitate that, by having the accepting physician speak directly with one of our physicians, serving as a mediator, a transfer of information. Sometimes that works. Sometimes they still demand on speaking to the sending doctor. But the key here is to avoid inevitable delays. We want to be able to secure a bed. We want to be able to confirm a bed so we can launch the aircraft. And if there's a delay because the accepting doctor demands on speaking to the sending doctor, that poses a problem. So, once again, we have done this for many, many years. And we have facilitated and streamlined the process, particularly in South Florida, because a lot of the transfers that we do are from the Caribbean bases in Latin America. And we have an agreement with the Broward Healthcare System in Florida. They expedite our admissions. We have a long history of transferring patients to their facility. Essentially, what we do is provide the information that we have. They do not require a doctor to doctor. As long as there's financial governance, as long as the medical expense coverage when they arrive there is taken care of, they immediately accept the patient. That streamlines the process. That's what we call one-stop shopping. So now we got acceptance of the patient. Now we can launch an aircraft. Now we can expedite moving that patient.
So I think one statement that you can make is that time is life, and it's kind of important to make that transfer quick. How does your organization, International SOS, how do you pick and choose the hospitals that you'll deal with? I mean, do you have a list of hospitals that you go through, 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, whatever? Do you guys have that all set up? Is that all decided?
We prefer, as I mentioned, the one-stop shopping arrangement that we have with Broward. But obviously, that's if they're coming in through that entry port of South Florida. But if an individual is going into the West Coast, for example, or coming into the Northeast, then that becomes a more complicated process. We can still do it. Obviously, we call the hospital. Frequently, a lot of these large hospitals have international departments. We go through their admission process. Most of the time nowadays, they end up being admitted to a hospitalist service. So we have to speak directly to the hospitalist and make sure that they understand that we may not have all the information that they request. Some of these complicated patients, they want to know vital signs. They want to know, you know, specific lab values. That may not be readily available. So we give them what we have. We said, look, this is what we got. You know, we'll try to get further information from you. But again, you know, if we haven't worked with that hospital consistently, if they don't know us as an organization, that frequently generates further delays. But the decision of destination is dependent on, number one, where the patient wants to go to. Number two, as I mentioned before, who's going to pay? Because more often than not, everybody wants to undergo the more cost-efficient method of transport, which will be to the nearest facility that can provide that higher level of care. And sometimes that doesn't fall within, you know, the wishes of the individual, the family member. So we need to be able to juggle that information and justify where we're going, and then just deal with, you know, the necessary arrangements as may be demanded by the receiving facility and the receiving medical team.
Got it. So so basically then, if somebody has, say, a spinal injury and they want to go to a certain center, then how does the communication go? I mean, they call your service for transport, say, from South America, and they want to go to a spine center in Los Angeles. How do you guys deal with that?
Well, we will take that into consideration as the primary source and the primary call that we will make, especially if the individual is from that area. If they've already established with that hospital, then it facilitates the process because they already have a record of that individual at that facility. If they're just picking that facility simply because they realize that it's a great hospital and based on the diagnosis of spinal injury, they want to go to, say, Stanford on the West Coast, even though they live, you know, in the heartland, well, then we need to rationalize with them with regards to what the appropriate care may be delivered elsewhere as well. But again, it ultimately boils down to cost and who's going to undertake the cost. Because needless to say, coming from South America, there are centers of medical excellence within the United States in the Houston area or in the Texas area or even in the Florida area that can provide a similar level of care as would be, say, in the West Coast. So, you know, the cost is going to be much greater because of longer distance flying to the West Coast. So we need to make sure that they understand if they're willing to undertake the additional cost, then we can certainly make every effort that we can to in order to secure a bed. But the ultimate decision here is not only cost, but availability of a bed. We frequently have run into situations where we call a hospital. They tell us that, you know, fine, we'll accept the patient, but we don't have a bed available. You know, and now, you know, we're calling them every day in order to be able to secure a bed. We can't launch the aircraft and then we know we have a bed available. So now time, as you mentioned before, time is of the essence. You know, time is flying by in a patient that could be critically ill that requires a higher level of care simply because they're demanding a bed at a hospital that doesn't have a bed available when we could make expedited arrangements elsewhere.
Well, now talking about bed available, you mentioned the whole city of Chicago did not have a bed available. So that's pretty impressive to tell you how in these crisis situations like COVID, et cetera, that things can get pretty bottled up, and that makes your job a lot harder because you're going to get there, but you need to be able to get that guy or girl to the right place.
Exactly.
So I'm glad you got the job and not me. let me ask you this. I mean, how about something really goes bad? Say you've got a cardiac and they discern that they need a stent, and the patient's best place is somewhere in Florida. Whatever happens if someone happens to die, you know, en route, because these are incredibly sick people, what happens to that patient, family, et cetera? How does that work out?
Well, technically speaking, if an individual dies in flight and death is formally declared, in other words, he's pronounced, by international law, the body needs to be disembarked at the next stop, whether that's the final destination or whether it's one of the intervening layovers. But the goal, obviously, is being able to get the patient or the body at that point to the final destination. Understanding with most, if not all, air ambulance providers, you have to avoid pronouncing the patient mid-flight. So if a patient expires during the flight, then the air ambulance providers, the medical team taking care of the patient, doesn't pronounce the patient. The same happens in commercial aircraft, where the patient codes and a code is carried out within the limits of what can be done, because very few of them are successful on a commercial airplane. If the patient is resuscitated, then under most circumstances, the flight would then need to be diverted to the nearest center, obviously, because you have a critically ill patient where they can't do nothing further on a commercial flight. But if the patient expires, then they're doing chest compressions after 30 minutes or so, seemingly appropriate resuscitation efforts. There's no evidence of change. There's no recovery. Then the resuscitation efforts can be stopped, and the body at that point continues on to final destination, where they are pronounced upon arrival. When the patient basically is disembarked at the final destination, then they're pronounced in order to avoid any problems with regards to transporting a dead body across state lines or across international boundaries. The issue becomes if, for example, this occurs early in a flight of an air ambulance transfer and there's intervening layovers for refueling, because legally speaking, as I mentioned before, the body would need to be disembarked. So for whatever reason, if a customs official would board the plane on one of these layovers, then they would see a patient that appears to be mechanically ventilated. The equipment is left on. The patient is unresponsive. But you know, most of these non-medical customs officials rarely ask questions. They just see the transport of a critically ill patient, even though at that point the patient essentially has expired. So the goal is obviously to get them to final destination. So more of these air ambulance providers understand that, you know, we certainly don't want to disembark the body. That, it opens up a whole Pandora's box of implications of now having to get the body back to the final destination.
So
additional problem, if a patient's a DNR, for example, do not resuscitate, and the order has been established before the flight has taken place, and the patient suffers a sudden demise, aggressive measures are pursued, and there's a family member, as I mentioned before many times, there's a family member that is transported with these patients on these air ambulances. Then if the family member decides to basically not pursue any further aggressive measures, then the code is called. But it becomes quite difficult, as you can understand. Now you're transporting a body with a grieving loved one, a frustrated medical team that wasn't able to keep the patient alive. These instances are few and far between, but not entirely unexpected.
So in that case, if you arrived at the airport, does the air ambulance team pronounce the body before they exit the plane?
Or we'll arrange a ground ambulance team to come over, and the pronouncement is made through the ground ambulance team and whatever medical support they have at the place of destination. No, the air ambulance team doesn't make the pronouncement. Because then the question would be, well, why didn't you pronounce them beforehand? So,
I got it. Yeah, tough call.
That responsibility is given to the resources at the landing site, where we call the paramedics that have come to site. They see the patient. They realize the patient's expired. I mean, they're not going to question whether did he die just now or did he die 2 or 3 hours ago. It's just understood that this is the way that things are going to go.
Gotcha. Now, how about different countries? Is there any countries where transfers tougher or issues become more evident that you have to put up on your alert list?
Well, yeah. There's many government restrictions. There's bureaucratic implications obtaining permits, entering and leaving certain countries. Venezuela, for example, it's very difficult to get patients out of Venezuela because we can't use any air ambulance providers that are licensed or originate in the United States. That's obviously because of the diplomatic severance that has occurred there. So that means that we can only evacuate or take patients out of Venezuela if we're using providers that are coming from other countries. We have an air ambulance provider that's very good out of Mexico, for example. We have another air ambulance provider we use out of Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. They're the only ones that can go into Venezuela simply because they're not registered or licensed, you know, within the United States. There's security restrictions in many countries. For example, Israel, who has an excellent high standard of medical care. However, they have extremely strict security measures that prohibit the transfer of any patient from any Middle Eastern country into Israel. So most of these patients, rather than moving them to a closer destination that has appropriate care, just like Israel, then we have to move them much farther to Western Europe because of those restrictive security measures. There's political reasons why we don't move patients out of, for example, North Korea or Iran. It's much more difficult. We just don't move them out of those countries. We don't get requests for it. Iraq and Afghanistan, we did move patients a lot, especially during the military times with U.S. Incursions into Iraq and Afghanistan. We would be moving many times subcontractors that were working for the U.S. government or the U.S. military. We have air ambulance providers that are based out of Dubai that have the capability to move these patients. And again, much more costly. Obviously, the insurance cost for these air ambulance providers, because they're going into war zones, is much higher, so that the cost of moving a patient a much shorter distance becomes much more expensive simply because of the necessary insurance that these air ambulance providers had to get in order to basically move patients in that country. Cuba is another country that poses challenges. There are air ambulance companies based out of the U.S. that can go into, they have permits to enter Cuba. And we do a lot of evacuations out of Guantanamo Bay, which is essentially a piece of U.S. territory within Cuba that's owned by the U.S. Navy. We frequently evacuate all types of patients that have all kinds of medical and mental health issues out of Guantanamo Bay, which is basically, as I said, a naval base, which is part of the U.S. within the eastern border of Cuba. But any other country, although they may pose individual challenges with regards to entry, requirements, permits, there may be additional delays, but we've pretty much moved patients out of any other country with those limitations in mind.
So let me just get back to something a little easier for you. How about something like malaria? Because I've seen two cases with malaria, once while I was in Chicago and one other place in Jersey. Do you run into malaria patients? Is there anything special you have to do with those individuals who can actually die on you too?
Well, malaria, as you know, is certainly quite prevalent, you know, particularly in the African continent, and we've had some cases even in South America. Yeah, absolutely, we can move those patients like any other infectious disease. You know, contagiousness is not an issue there, so we certainly don't need to take extreme measures with regards to isolation or isolation chambers, but it all depends on how stable that individual may be, you know, prior to transfer. We find a lot of times that malaria patients, you know, can be quite brittle. They can certainly go south quite quickly. But if somebody's diagnosed as having malaria and we feel that the course of that disease is not going the way that we anticipated, you know, we could do every effort in order to move them out of particularly West Africa, and those patients typically get moved either to Western Europe, either to Paris, to London, sometimes over to Switzerland or Germany, or sometimes going south to South Africa, Johannesburg, where there's a very good high level of care. Of course, keeping in mind nowadays with the pandemic, and you mentioned Omicron in South Africa being, you know, prevalent now, that adds going you know, further consideration with regards to securing a receiving care bed for these patients that is going to place further obstacles and impediments in order to be able to receiving care and secure a bed, particularly if these individuals are not nationals of those countries. It's become increasingly more difficult to get people into Western Europe, into France or into Germany, if they're not French, if they're not German, or if they don't have established double citizenship or residency in those countries. A country national of Western Africa, somebody from Sierra Leone, Liberia, somebody from Ghana that gets malaria, many times we're going to have a very difficult time moving a critically ill patient to one of these other higher levels of care simply because they don't have the appropriate documentation to enter that country.
Wow. So the answer is that to me is because I know malaria is known for people to go into renal insufficiency. Do you guys also do dialysis on board too?
There are very few air ambulance companies that will undertake that. What typically we'll do is we'll wait if the patient is getting intermittently dialyzed, you know, we'll have them dialyzed immediately before transport, and then obviously take them to a facility to get dialyzed upon arrival. Continuous filtration and or continuous hemodialysis is something, just like ECMO, that very few companies would even attempt to transport a patient under those circumstances. They prefer to have the patient, you know, stabilized and not have to undertake that type of intervention in flight.
Well, I want to thank you for my geography lesson today. Let me ask you this. How many vaccinations do your staff have to get before they can hop on a plane and transport people back to safety or higher levels of care?
Well, nowadays, everybody obviously has to have, you know, COVID vaccination. That's, you know, a given. Yellow fever vaccination is a must. You know, typhoid fever. Once again, depending on where you're going to go, don't forget that most of these transports are done to extract patients from a limited location, so that you're not going to be spending much time there. You're going from the airport to the hospital, picking up the patient, going back to the aircraft and taking off. So for the most part, the necessary ones are, needless to say, COVID nowadays, you know, the routine vaccinations that you would get through childhood immunization. Yellow fever is also a must. But beyond that, besides the usual vaccinations that everyone should, you know, be getting, including the flu vaccine yearly, those are the ones that we, you know, most air ambulance companies demand that their crew be up to date on.
So Al, I know when you have a free moment, you have longly worked at the ER in Inspira Medical Center. How's Inspira compared to air transport? That was it's one of the busiest ERs around. So how do you compare and contrast?
Different set of variables altogether, really. Needless to say, when you're on an aircraft, you're dealing with limited capability. It is an ICU in the air, as I mentioned before, but needless to say, you're still limited with regards to what you can do. You know, very few times we've had to divert an aircraft simply because a patient, you know, we feel can get an appropriate care delivered on the ground better than in the air. The goal is always to get a patient to final destination, but rarely is that something that becomes absolutely impossible. But as far as, you know, managing a patient in an emergency room, face it, as you know, in an emergency room, you know, I'd say 75% of the things that you're seeing are not true emergencies. So it becomes a lot easier. When you're moving these patients on an air ambulance, you know, these are people that, for the most part, are critically ill, that require a much higher level of care, and you need to be on your toes with regards to what you're doing.
So you mean to tell me when you work in an ER, your stress hormones are off the wall, but when you work on an air ambulance, they're all the way up to heaven, I guess.
That's a good way of putting it. It's a different approach altogether.
All right, Al Castanos, Dr. Castanos, thank you very much for joining us. You are a fantastic guest, and everybody knows a little bit more about how the world gets smaller for people like you, who you make it smaller. Thanks a lot, Al, for hopping on Inside Medicine. We'll be back next week. Over and out from Dr. Joe Fallon. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thanks.